This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Finding Your Bliss with host Judy Liebrack, heard every Saturday at 1 p.m. on Zoomer Radio.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Finding Your Bliss, the show that helps you find and follow your bliss. I'm Judy Liebrack, and today we have someone on the show whose career I've been following for years, watching it develop and flourish with great admiration. And I always knew that I wanted to have him on the show, and so I'm really delighted to be joined today by author and acclaimed freelance journalist, Jared Lindzen. Before we meet him, let me tell you a little bit more about him. Jared Lindzen is an author, freelance journalist, and public speaker based in Toronto. After more than 12 years reporting for publications like Fast Company, Time Magazine, The Globe and Mail, and Toronto Star, Lindzen has emerged as one of the leading voices on the future of work in the age of artificial intelligence, also known as AI. His forthcoming book, Do More in 4, Why It's Time for a Shorter Work Week. And you can see my dog-eared copy right here. This was published by Harvard Business Review Press on January 13th, 2026. And his writing has also been featured in the New York Times, the BBC, The Guardian, Fortune Magazine, and, this blew me away, Rolling Stone Magazine. As a public speaker, Lindzen shares the data, real-world stories, and lessons learned from his reporting on topics like artificial intelligence, leadership, entrepreneurship, and the future of work. He has also appeared on panels alongside some of the world's leading business, political, and cultural leaders at conferences and conventions all over the world. Lindzen earned an MA in journalism and an honors BA in media studies from Western University. Jared Lindzen, welcome to Finding Your Bliss. So happy to have you here.
Thanks so much, Judy. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Jared, I've known you for years. And as mentioned, I've really watched your burgeoning freelance writing career with much admiration and delight. And before today, I sort of noted to myself that a lot of kids graduate from journalism school and they struggle as freelancers, but you have had what feels like a meteoric climb since graduating and beyond, writing for some of the most impressive publications in the world. I mentioned some of them off the top, but if you're just tuning in now, including the New York Times, wow, Rolling Stone Magazine, Time Magazine, the Globe and Mail, the Toronto Star, the National Post, and Fortune, just to name a few. And now there's a forthcoming book. So first off, congratulations on all of this. Do More in 4. It's really, really heady stuff. Before we dive into the book, I'd love to take a step back and talk about that moment when you knew that you were a writer and wanted to pursue a serious career in journalism. And my research and understanding is that part of this began when you were volunteering for the school newspaper in university and you were sitting in a windowless office and you started to notice, you know, in that back room with 20 other students, that what you were doing, what you were scribbling, what you were writing was having a major impact on the university campus. Your words were powerful and what you were writing about mattered. Was that the moment where you knew that this is what you wanted to do for the rest of your life?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I went into media studies because I thought it was interesting and I knew I was good at writing essays and I wanted some essay heavy academic topics where a lot of the course materials were TV shows and movies and comic books. So that really interested me in media studies, but I didn't really know what I was going to do with that media studies degree when I started in the program. And a lot of my friends were very quick to start trying to gain some experience on campus, whether they're volunteering for the radio station or the newspaper. Some of them even started a graphic design business together. And so I tried my hand at a few of those different ones just to see where I fit. And yeah, the newspaper really stuck with me. I enjoyed the fact that I could write something one day and see people reading it on the bus on the way to school the next morning, which was really interesting to me because they distributed this, you know, the Western Gazette all over the town of London, Ontario. And then on top of that, you know, what really sealed it for me, as you mentioned, there was one story in particular where members of the Disabled Students Union came to the Gazette office in that windowless room at the University Community Center, and they were complaining that there was insufficient accessibility accommodations on campus. It was basically taking them half an hour to get from one building to the next, especially in the middle of winter. And there was one door with a ramp on the back of the building, but they couldn't go through the front door. There was one specific elevator that they could use in some of these buildings. And so the university had promised these students an appropriate accommodation so they can get to and from classes, but they were missing 20 minutes of the beginning of class or at the end just to get around. And so they came to us to tell us about some of these issues and the fact that there was nothing in the upcoming student council budget to address it. And so I wrote this story. And within a few days, the budget was amended, and there was all of a sudden these new ramps and accessible accommodations being built on campus. And so very, quite literally, like the words that I wrote within days were having a tangible impact on this little community and the people who called it home for this, you know, period of during our academic studies. And that was when I realized that that was just a microcosm of what's possible if I were to pursue this as a career.
I think also you want to make the world a better place. It's really interesting. I've noticed that in your writing and even how you passionately told the story, your eyes lit with animation when you talked about making a difference. I have followed your career and at first was duly impressed by the internship at the National Post, followed by the writing at the Toronto Star and the Globe. What gave you the confidence to venture into self-employment and publish stories for some of the most revered newspapers and magazines in the world? I know you had an employer that wasn't your favorite and you decided at that moment, I want to be in charge of my own writing career. But what gave you the confidence to do it?
Yeah, it was making that leap was definitely the most difficult decision of my life, as it is for almost anyone who's gone into self-employment, whether it's small business ownership or entrepreneurship or freelancing like myself. That initial jump is by far the scariest part. For me, I was in a job I really didn't like, as you mentioned. It wasn't, you know, I got this journalism degree. I was super fired up and passionate about the potential of being a journalist, having that impact on the community and the world, and wasn't really finding that in my first job out of school. Didn't love the culture, didn't love the work environment, didn't love the fact that a lot of what we were doing wasn't really journalism. It leveraged journalism skills, but it was storytelling on behalf of brands, which isn't why I got into this business. So I was always looking for a way out. And I started telling friends, classmates who were in journalism school that I was interested in whatever work they had. My friends who were interning for the Toronto Star, the Globe and Mail, wherever it was, I'll take anything that you can give me on a freelance basis and I'll find a way to get it done. And so for that first year at this new job, right out of school, I was writing articles for the Toronto Star during my lunch break, or, you know, I was doing interviews in the stairwell, hoping that my boss didn't happen to take the stairs at that time and catch me in the middle of recording an interview. I also try to use the time zones to my advantage. So a lot of my stories in the early days were with sources in Vancouver because I could interview them as soon as I got home and they were still at their desk. And so I did that for a good while until I felt like I was writing for the Star, the Post, and the Globe in a very limited capacity, you know, a story or two a month for each. I had interned myself at the National Post and still had contacts, and my friends were off of the Globe and the Star and offering me some work through their editors. And so finally, I decided I was at a point where I was turning down some of the work that I was really passionate about to do more of the stuff that I wasn't. And that's when I realized that I had to make the switch. It was very scary financially. It was actually just weeks after I moved out of my parents' house and was living alone. And so not much, it wasn't the best decision financially, but it was the best decision for me at that time. And I'm really glad that I made it.
You even wrote for the career section of the Toronto Star when you started. Like, that's like a great gig. And what I love about all of this also is that it's almost like you created this idea of writing about work as you were looking for work. It was like the play within the play, right?
You know, I totally fell into it. It was actually an editor at the Globe and Mail. I had met with this editor and just said, like, where should I be focusing my energy and my time? And I said, I wanted to be a freelancer. I wanted to work remotely. And at that time, I was 23-ish. So part of this new millennial generation that people were still trying to figure out. And he said, oh, those are all the topics, you know, freelancing, remote working, millennials. Those are the things that our careers department is trying to write about and struggling to figure out. You'd be a really good fit to start writing about that. And so I just started and I realized that I was writing about the things that I was living from personal experience, which gave me an interesting perspective. And I feel like really helped in some of those early reporting.
So you've written about money for Fortune magazine, politics for Politico, cryptocurrency for CoinDesk, and music for Rolling Stone, which we're going to get to. You've helped Time magazine put together their list of the top inventions of the year. You write about Canada for publications, including the BBC. Wow. You even wrote a piece about mental health for the New York Times called How Skydiving Cured My Depression. Love that piece. And I want to share a little sample of your writing in that article for our listeners.
Please.
So here we go. Linked together by a few carabiner clips, they waddled towards the open doorway. One diver was a middle-aged woman with a British accent. She hung on to shoulder straps that actually attached her to a sunburned Australian instructor. It almost looked like he was her human knapsack. Oh, love that line. Except that is for Dubai. Years before taking a seat on the only airplane I didn't also land in, I began seeing pictures and videos on social media of friends and celebrities taking their first dive there. Something about the combination of crystal blue water, man-made islands, desert, mountains, glass, steel, and the shape it all made from 13,000 feet really stuck with me. Years ago, I promised myself that if I ever made it there, I would try a jump, assuming deep down that I was just telling myself that, and I really never would. In those months of darkness, I was too afraid to put myself out there. But you know what's scarier than rejection? Jumping out of an airplane. I was too afraid to take risks, but you know what's scarier than failure? Jumping out of an airplane. I was too afraid to talk to anyone about, much less write and publish a story about, my battle with depression. But you know what's scarier than being vulnerable? Take a guess. Jared, I love your writing. I also love your humor. I'm wondering if you got this from loving cartoons when you were younger, which I know you had a real penchant for.
Wow. I'm impressed that you even know that, but yes.
What was it like for you actually jumping out of that airplane? Did you do it for the experience or so that you could write about it?
I never planned to write about it. I didn't expect any of the things that happened to me, you know, emotionally, mentally, that did happen to happen. I had made this promise to myself that if I ever made it to Dubai for any reason, I would try to go skydiving again, assuming that I never would. And then when I got there, I went to the flight school and I'd gone all the way there. I decided I had to go wait in line and put my name down. And they said, you know, we're fully booked for today. We'll let you know if there's a cancellation, but we're probably not going to be able to let you jump out of a plane today. So I thought, okay, I've done the thing that I promised myself I would do if I ever came to this place. And then I got the call that someone had canceled last minute and they had a spot open and we'll see you in 20 minutes. And I think before I even had a chance to process it, I was already in the airplane. And when that door opened, like that's quite a moment to suddenly be in an airplane that's missing a wall. That was really when I processed what was about to happen. And it happened so fast. And the jump itself, the free fall is maybe 90 seconds, probably closer to 60 seconds. And then, you know, there's another 5 minutes of gently gliding to the ground, you know, in the parachute. But, you know, 6-7 minutes after this all began, I was on the ground shaking, trying to figure out what had just happened to me. But again, I had been in this like battle with depression for months leading up to it. And of course, I didn't connect any of these pieces at that time. But after it was over, it felt like something was just rewired in my brain. Like it just jogged something. I spent a lot of time talking to psychologists and trying to figure out what exactly happened. There's a lot of theories. There's a lot of connections between extreme sports and mental health. It's less sort of clearly defined, but people know that a lot of the times when you're in a depressive state, your brain is kind of stuck in this negative thought process and it takes something scary
to jolt you. Yes.
And it just happens so. It was such a night and day experience that, you know, before going on that airplane, I was in this 7-9 month long battle with depression and I landed on the ground and just all those thoughts were gone. And it took me a really long time to process what had happened, even longer to even consider writing about it. I think I actually mentioned it casually to an editor at the New York Times that I've always wanted to write the story about how skydiving cured my depression. He said, yes, that's the one. We're going to do that one. And I thought, oh God, now I have to write about depression. I had never told anybody that I had gone through depression. I had to then sit down with every member of my family, all of my close friends, and tell them this thing that I had been hiding for so long because, you know, otherwise they were going to read about it in the New York Times.
Okay. Did you tell your parents before you jumped or after?
Oh, I told my dad before and my mom after.
Smart. Good thinking. Good thinking.
My dad was very supportive. My mom, even though she found out afterwards, was livid. But that's all right.
Did you feel elated when it was over? Was part of that feeling in your sort of in that, I'm sure there was so many things going on, a kaleidoscope of emotions, but was one of those emotions elation?
I guess, you know, it was so confusing. I just kind of like, you know, you land on the ground, they take your picture, they pack up the parachute and they walk away. And I'm just standing there shaking, like, what in the heck just happened to me? And it took me like, I had to go sit down and just take a few breaths and like really process. Yeah, I think elation may have been one of the many things that I was feeling at that time, but it took a while just to process.
Wow. I got to hand it to you. It's really, really incredible.
Thank you.
I keep feeling that it must be a juggling act for you when you're freelancing. Like either you have a very good Excel spreadsheet or you're a very organized thinker or you're just good at multitasking, but that's a hard thing to be juggling all these stories and stairwells and other places. I mean, really, how do you do it? What are the skills that are required in order to do that?
No, I love it and I wouldn't want it any other way, but it's definitely not for everyone. And it took me a long time to figure out that was for me, that it's the way that I work best. I think the first hint was that, as mentioned, after university, I interned for the National Post. It was actually part of my graduate program. And then I did some more interning for them afterwards. And the daily news cycle, the idea that you show up in the morning, especially as an intern, and you have no idea what in the world you're going to be writing about that day. And by the afternoon, you've talked to five people about it, you're borderline an expert on it, you've written an article about it. And then the day after, it's in the newspaper.
Yes.
That pace, for some people, would scare them away. For me, I just loved it. I love that no 2 days were the same. I love that there was this constant juggling of different assignments and so many things happening on the go, and the unpredictability and the excitement that came with it. Really, it spoke to me. And so as a freelancer, it's been a lot of the same. Yes, it does require a lot of organization, you know, staying on top of different deadlines, different requirements, responsibilities. I have both a spreadsheet where I do all of my accounting and finances, but then I also have a legal pad where I have my weekly to-do list on the left and the days broken down on the right in terms of which day I'm going to do each of those things. Just little systems like that. I've been doing it for 12 years now, and you know, all of these systems have kind of come into place over the years. But yeah, it would be very difficult to start from scratch, but over time you figure out what works for you. And for me, I don't know that I could work any other way at this point.
Isn't that incredible? You've interviewed, Jared, some of the most high-profile business people, and one of them that really blew me away when I read about it was your interview with Bill Gates. Can you tell us how you landed an interview with the tech mogul and co-founder of Microsoft, the man who really transformed a simple idea about personal computers into a global revolution? What was it like interviewing him for the article? And everyone, you can check this out. You can Google this. Bill Gates opens up about his obsessive tendencies, dropping acid, and his three-hour dinner with Donald Trump. I love what you did with it. What was that experience like for you?
That was a wild experience. It was almost exactly a year ago. It was in, I think, late December when I just got an email out of the blue saying, would you like to interview Bill Gates about his new book in a couple of weeks? Now, the reason why I was chosen, so I write a weekly or twice monthly, depending on the schedule, column for the Toronto Star. I interview a Canadian or global CEO and do a bit of a profile, a bit of a Q&A with a different business leader. You can find that on the Toronto Star's website. I've interviewed some really incredible Canadian CEOs, some incredible global CEOs, but that column was kind of known in the business world a little bit, enough so that when Bill Gates's publicity team was looking to market the book in Canada, he wrote a book last year, they were given a few options for, you know, which column might be a good fit for him. And they identified the one that I wrote for the Toronto Star as that one. So it was a little bit of like sheer luck, right place at the right time, but also the fact that I've been doing this column for a couple of years, and obviously I'd done something right with it to the point where, you know, his team felt that the one print interview he was going to do in Canada was going to be with me. So a little bit of luck, a little bit of just sort of like the overnight success story that was a few years in the making.
Yes.
And then interviewing him was quite the experience. So I read his book, which was about his childhood, and, you know, really it stops just as he's founding Microsoft. So it's it's really about how he went from just a social reject, sort of high school kid, trying to figure things out, falling in love with computers, meeting his friends who became his future co-founders of Microsoft, and all of those childhood experiences. And so the conversation was really fascinating. I picked up on a few things that I think were surprising to me. First of all, he is funny. He is legitimately, he had me laughing on multiple occasions. I didn't expect him to be that funny. I also noticed that when I asked him a question, he didn't answer right away. He stopped, he paused, he closed his eyes. Sometimes he rocks back and forth, which he writes about in the book, is something that he does when he's concentrating. And he really chose his words carefully each time. And I feel like that, you know, I interview hundreds of people and I've never really seen someone that focused on like trying to communicate the best possible answer. And I feel like that's just sort of the guy that he is. And then the most incredible part about all of that is that I had been asking for weeks with his team, with my editors at the Toronto Star, would it be okay if I asked Bill a question for my book? Because he's talked about the 4-day work week in the past, and I just so happen to be writing this book about the 4-day work week. Wouldn't it be incredible if I got some original quotes from Bill Gates about the 4-day work week? And literally the night before the interview at like 11 p.m., I got an email from his team confirming that it was okay if I asked a couple questions to include in the book. So a lot of stars aligned for that one.
Were you like, talk about shaking when you got off the plane jump, like were you almost like after it was over? I'm just thinking like, I'm an entertainment journalist as well. So that's like, to me, like interviewing, I don't know, Oprah or Meryl Streep or something. Like it's just, it's beyond, right?
I used to get really starstruck. I've had the huge fortune to interview some people that I look up to and consider heroes or people that, have that effect. I think over time, you get a little bit more desensitized to it. There's always that feeling of like, oh my God, I'm talking to so-and-so. But I think if you do it a few times, you can kind of repress it a little bit. Yeah. So I was just happy that when the interview was over, I got a lot of really interesting stuff from him. And I think that comes through in the story that came out of it.
Yeah, the story is fantastic. I encourage everyone to check that out. And I know we're getting to the book, but I also want to talk to you about writing an article about music for Rolling Stone magazine. That must have been a trip. Like, I'm sorry, that's just a trip, right? The actual article itself in Rolling Stone magazine was in fact called Inside Wall Street's Deadhead Society by Jared Lindzen. And I want to, again, just share some of your evocative, exquisite writing in Rolling Stone magazine with our listeners. We're going to do that right after this commercial break. We'll be right back in a moment.
Finding Your Bliss is brought to you by Create, Canada's leading fertility center for over 25 years.
Create is here for anyone struggling with infertility or in need of assisted reproductive technology to have children. Create is about cutting-edge science from highly skilled doctors. In unprecedented times like these, Create is about ensuring the safety of all patients and staff. Create has made important changes to protect you by ensuring social distancing, wearing masks, as well as screening before entering. So what about the bundle of joy that you've been hoping would come into your family? Create Fertility Center is here for you. Visit createivf.com to keep up with the latest changes and learn about Create Fertility Center's comprehensive care for every fertility journey. Keep safe and healthy during these challenging days, remembering that life is about moments that we create together.
Hey everyone, we're back and this is Finding Your Bliss on Zoomer Radio, AM 740, FM 96.7. And I'm here with celebrated freelance journalist and co-author of The 4-Day Work Week, Jared Lindzen. And just before the break, I was about to share an excerpt from your piece, Jared, called Inside Wall Street's Deadhead Society in Rolling Stone magazine. You write, and I quote, I love this piece. One evening in October 2015, an Irish bar in Midtown Manhattan hosts a mixer for Wall Street executives. though it more closely resembles a hippie commune reunion. The venue's wooden bars and stained glass windows are covered in glow sticks, lava lamps, beanie babies, and framed portraits of rock gods from a bygone era. Known as Tir na n'Og, or Land of Youth in Irish folklore, the aptly named establishment begins to fill with mostly middle-aged patrons grinning with an expression of youthful excitement. The dress code ranges from tie-dye to black tie. I mean, come on, love that line. Distinguishing the out-of-towners from those who rushed over directly from work. A Grateful Dead cover band, the Deadbeats, tunes their instruments on a small stage, typically reserved for Irish folk singers, in front of a hula hoop ready to be twirled once guests have time to swarm the open bar. I mean, oh, I love this. What was that like for you to land this gig writing for Rolling Stone? Man, that's like a dream of every young, yeah. I'd say male, female, I don't know, anyone.
I mean, so like, yeah, you don't go into journalism without seeing Almost Famous and dreaming of that life. Everyone could be, you know, Russell Crowe and exist in that world. But the craziest thing about it was that years ago, as a student in journalism school, I reached out to the founder of the magazine and he wrote me back. And We were writing back and forth for a little while. He answered his emails very quickly. And I was pitching him ideas for years and none of them really stuck, obviously. And I was early in my career. I wasn't even freelancing. I really was just trying to get something that, you know, it's really hard as a 23-year-old fresh out of school to find a story idea that Rolling Stone wants that their editors and writers haven't already thought of.
Yes.
And so in 2015, I was actually briefly living in New York, and through a source that I interviewed for a completely unrelated financial story, he said, you know, you should meet this person who runs this networking community for Wall Street executives who are also huge fans of the Grateful Dead. And it was super interesting. We met. I learned that like there was this whole community of, I would say, the folks who, like, you know, these were people who were at Woodstock, hanging out in San Francisco in the 60s and 70s and went on to work in Wall Street, which seems like worlds apart. But there's a lot of them and they kind of know each other and they kind of have this whole society. And you actually, in order to join the group, they test you on your knowledge of the Grateful Dead. Like, if you, they'll ask you your favorite song, and if it's one of like the basic, you know, the acclaimed songs, you're out right away. And so I met with this woman. She told me that journalists have been asking her for a story for years. And she did an interview a long time ago. She was misquoted. She was really upset. And she hasn't spoken to a journalist since. And I really spent a long time just trying to gain her trust, trying to prove that I was actually like a fan of the same music that she was, even though we were in different generations, and that I was really not trying to do anything other than share the interesting story. And once she finally agreed that I could be the first journalist inside this group for one of their events and write this, I sent that to my pen pal, who was the founder of Rolling Stone magazine, and made it happen. And that was the first of, I think, three or four articles I did for Rolling Stone, but definitely the most memorable.
Did you frame the check?
I have it in a box somewhere in my storage room. I didn't frame it, but I definitely have it somewhere still.
That's very, very cool. Congratulations on all
Thank
of this.
You know, it was 2015. I was quite young. I did not have the money to frame it. Maybe I should now.
See, there's an idea.
Yeah.
So, Jared, your writing focuses on technology, entrepreneurship, politics, and the future of work. In fact, we, as mentioned, one of your first gigs was writing for the career sections of Toronto Star newspaper. You also write about the future of work for the Globe and Mail, for Fast Company, and all of this. You've been invited to speak at many business schools, post-secondary institutions, conferences, and industry events about what the changing world of work, as it were, means for various audiences. What fascinates you and makes you so passionate still about this subject?
There's a lot there. I think the first thing that drew me to it, besides the fact that, again, an editor had identified that I was a good fit for the buzzwords that they were trying to write about in the career section as a millennial freelancer, remote worker, they just wanted to figure out what those things meant. And so I did kind of naturally fall into it. I also found that music journalism was very competitive. A lot of people were willing to work for free, including myself at that time. So there wasn't a lot of money in it in terms of like a freelance gig. And so I was looking for something that was more sustainable in terms of a career. And so I did sort of fall into this future of work category, but I've always been interested in small business and entrepreneurship, just in general. There's a lot of entrepreneurs in my family. I kind of grew up in that world a little bit. So I know something about it and was always just fascinated by small business ownership and entrepreneurship, which again, you know, the freelancer side of things, really it's part and parcel with that. Part of the motivation is, interestingly enough, as you correctly pointed out, I grew up watching a lot of silly cartoons. And the one thing that the Jetsons, the Flintstones, and the Simpsons, and Family Guy, and whatever other cartoon I was watching at a young age, the one thing that they all had in common is that the men went to work and hated it.
Yes.
They all had a job they hated, a boss that they hated. They were always trying to get out of work. They were always being yelled at for being a minute late or not dressed appropriately or not being professional. There was this trope of growing up that like work was a painful, difficult, adversarial thing that should be avoided and dreaded. And I always thought, like, why does it have to be like that? I don't want to live in that world. And I don't think anybody really benefits from that kind of existence. And so the more I was writing about the future of work, the more I realized that, you know, that attitude is quickly being replaced by something completely different. And that sort of focus on presence and time, and you have to be in this chair for 8 hours a day, even if you're not actually doing anything, you know, that's really inherited from the factory system of the industrial era, and that this isn't the way it's always been, and it's not the way it has to be. It just was the way things were when I was growing up. And it's been very encouraging to see such significant changes over that time, that the way we work has changed a lot in just the last 10 years. And I think it's going to continue to change. And so for me, it's an endlessly fascinating subject.
Absolutely. Your brainchild, Do More in 4, Why It's Time for a Shorter Work Week, which you co-authored with Joe O'Connor. How did it all evolve and come to be and happen?
Yeah. So mentioned my co-author, Joe. As someone who was writing about the future of work for lots of different publications, I ended up interviewing this guy named Joe O'Connor on multiple occasions. Joe ran a series of pilots in the UK, Europe, and North America and Australia, where he would gather a bunch of companies together and help them transition gradually and strategically to a four-day work week. And then he invited academic research institutions like Boston College and University College Dublin to study what would happen to those companies and their employees and their clients through this trial process. It was about a six-month trial. And so through all these pilot programs, the results were really fascinating. You'd think that reducing the amount of time people spend at work would have a lot of negative consequences, especially when it comes to productivity and efficiency. But the way in which they approached the four-day work week actually had the opposite effect. The companies were performing better after switching to a four-day work week. And I just thought that was so interesting, again, coming from a place of questioning why work is the way it is and whether it is the right way. This data was so interesting to me because it said something, you know, it got at something very fundamental, a thing that we think has to be this way because it's always been this way.
Right.
But neither of those are true. And so I interviewed Joe a bunch of times. And I thought the subject was really interesting. And then we met at a conference. I was hosting the Future of Work stage at the Elevate conference in Toronto in 2022. And Joe was a speaker at the conference. And so we finally met in person after talking on the phone a lot. Joe was from Ireland, hence the O'Connor, but he had just moved to Toronto with his partner, Grace. And, you know, we got together and we got to talking, and eventually he brought up the idea of going into a book project together. And really it was his encouragement and just my endless fascination with the subject that got us there.
Isn't that incredible? Do you think, Jared, that the pandemic has something to do with like this? I saw in one of the podcasts that you were on, and this idea that nobody wants to work anymore as a generation, this whole work ethic has changed. Do you think this is a result of the pandemic, or is it more complicated than that?
So I think the pandemic gave us permission to question the things that have always been the way that they were as far as work is concerned, because we discovered pretty early in the pandemic that most people, a lot of people, can be as effective working from home as they are in person, which completely upended a longstanding assumption. I know today it feels like remote work and hybrid work is kind of natural and commonplace. But as you'll recall, before the pandemic, you know, I was writing about these subjects and they were hugely controversial. And at that time, we were talking like 3 to 5% of the population was working remotely full time and another 5% was working in a hybrid model. But it was very much the exception, not the norm. And the assumption was that most people could not be effective working from home. And the pandemic really challenged that assumption. And in doing so, gave us permission to consider what other things that we've assumed about the standard work structure that we have today may be doing more harm than good, or at least may not be the right choice for everyone in every circumstance. Which I would say remote work is not necessarily the best option for everybody, but in-person work shouldn't necessarily be the only option for everybody. And I think similarly, the 4-day work week isn't necessarily the right choice for every organization. But I do think that like remote work, there's a lot more people and organizations that can benefit from it that haven't tried it yet because they just couldn't picture a different way of doing things.
What are all the cool things that you can do if you have a 4-day work week? I know you've probably thought about this a lot, but I just think about courses you can take and sports you can be involved in and exercise, things that you just don't have time for in that hectic 5-day work week. Thank God it's Friday, TGIF. Like, what are some of the benefits that you've learned about or thought about that come out of just having that 4-day work week?
Yeah. So from Joe's research and in, you know, further researching the subject, we've actually found there's a lot of benefits for individuals, organizations, and society at large. So you were asking about the individual side of things, and they actually did some research into like, what do people with a 4-day work week do with the extra time? We found that exercise is a big one. A lot of people spend the day doing administrative stuff, laundry, groceries, appointments, so that the weekend is actually time off, which a lot of people don't get to enjoy. For parents, it's hugely helpful, either because they get to spend one extra day with their kids, or if their kids are a little older, they get to spend one day of the week where they are neither a full-time parent nor a full-time worker. They have their own time. And so a lot of parents with kids in the elementary school age group were saying, I have these hobbies, these things that I used to do all the time and I used to love that I just didn't have time for once I had kids. Right. And now I've got a whole day to do. I can even do my weekend chores in the morning and have the afternoon to do the things that I forgot that I love to do because it's been so long. There's a lot of research to show that people are actually more environmentally conscious when they have a 4-day work week because you can bike and walk rather than drive. You have the time to do that. You can make yourself dinner rather than getting delivery. There's just a lot of environmental benefits that come with it. And yeah, you know, people tend to travel more. You've got the long weekend. Not every company does Fridays or Mondays off if they're doing a 4-day work week, but if they do, people go visit family that they don't get to see as often. There was one, the most heartwarming story that we saw was one person in one of the trials dedicated those Fridays to spending time with their grandfather. And every Friday they drove to, it was like a 3-hour drive to get to them and it just wasn't doable in their weekly schedule.
Wow.
And so they made a point of every Friday they would spend their afternoon with their elderly grandfather, and they ended up passing a few years later. And he says, like, this is time that it changed our lives and wouldn't have been possible otherwise. So it can be dramatic for sure.
What a lovely story. Thank you for sharing that. That's incredible. So asking for a friend, I know a workaholic who works, I said a 7-day week. You said you mean an 8-day work week. I think this book might be helpful for that person, right? The workaholic who really does work 7 days a week, doesn't even know from a 5-day work week. What do you say to the workaholic?
So I would say that for a lot of folks, especially those who are in leadership or management, they really don't have a 5-day work week. They, as you mentioned, the work week blends into the weekend, and that leaves them with very little time for themselves to rest and recover. And actually, we find that a lot of the times when a company moves to a 4-day work week, their self-proclaimed workaholics still work on Friday, but they're doing all the work that they would have done on Saturday and Sunday. And we have a lot of research that we reference in the book, and you can find just by Googling, that shows that people are actually more productive, more effective in their jobs when they return to work on Monday, having detached from work for a sufficient period of time. We are not machines. We don't just, you know, plug us in and we'll keep running forever. The human brain needs rest and relaxation and time away from work in order to do our best work. And so often we find that the people who are finally able to take a step back discover that they're more effective in the time that they spend working. They make less mistakes, they're more energized, they're just better prepared to give 100% for a shorter amount of time than just be there as much as possible. So I would actually, and we actually profile someone in the book who was a self-proclaimed workaholic, worked around the clock, started experiencing debilitating migraines, had to take a sabbatical to recover, and realized that being the best in their industry, which happened to be family law, required a regular stepping away from work in order to sustain peak performance. So if you actually want to be the best, you need to consider longevity and sustainability of your performance rather than going all out all the time, burning out, and having to take significant time away to recover.
I will be quoting you on this last 5 minutes. Okay. I love the reference to Seinfeld in your book, Do More in Four, and that story you tell where the character George left his car in the parking lot for days, so his workplace assumed that he was working all of this overtime. That was just so fascinating. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah. So going back to the whole idea that like the sitcom cartoon world has this like very specific portrayal of the worker boss relationship. Yeah. That was also true in the hit sitcom Seinfeld. And so in this episode, George Costanza locks his keys in his car by accident in the parking lot of his workplace, which happens to be for the New York Yankees. And every morning, his boss goes in first thing in the morning, sees his car in his designated spot in the parking lot and assumes George is already at his desk working away. And then the owner of the team leaves late at night. And as he's on his way out of the building, he sees George's car as the only car in the parking lot still there and assumes George is still at his desk. So George is actually off on an unapproved vacation while his bosses are debating whether or not to give him a promotion. And the episode really highlights this disconnect between presence and effectiveness. Yeah. We've always calculated productivity in hours, which is a thing that works really well in an assembly line, in an industrial economy. But the reality is there isn't as clear of a connection between the amount of time you spend at work and the actual value that you deliver. There's some people who can deliver a whole lot of value for their company in a very short amount of time and then spend the rest of the time sort of wasting hours. And so it just shows this disconnect between how we value what people are bringing to the table and what they're actually bringing to the table.
Yeah, the whole perception, it's fascinating. It's so fascinating. We're going to go on a short commercial break. When we come back, we'll hear more from acclaimed freelance journalist, Jared Lindzen, all about his new book, Do More in Four, Why It's Time for a Shorter Work Week. We'll be right back in a moment.
Finding Your Bliss is brought to you by Create, Canada's leading fertility center for over 25 years.
Create is here for anyone struggling with infertility or in need of assisted reproductive technology to have children. Create is about cutting-edge science from highly skilled doctors. In unprecedented times like these, Create is about ensuring the safety of all patients and staff. Create has made important changes to protect you by ensuring social distancing, wearing masks, as well as screening before entering. So what about the bundle of joy that you've been hoping would come into your family? Create Fertility Center is here for you. Visit createivf.com to keep up with the latest changes and learn about Create Fertility Center's comprehensive care for every fertility journey. Keep safe and healthy during these challenging days, remembering that life is about moments that we create together.
Hey everyone, we're back, and this is Finding Your Bliss on Zoomer Radio, AM 740. And we're here with freelance journalist and author Jared Lindzen, talking all about his latest book, Do More in Four, Why It's Time for a Shorter Work Week. Let's talk a little bit about AI, and I want you to sort of explain artificial intelligence a little bit for some listeners who may not be as familiar with the concept. But what makes you so positive about the effect of artificial intelligence in the workplace?
So yeah, AI is the big one. You know, it's hard to, as a tech reporter, journalist, person in this space, you know, we said that cryptocurrency and blockchain is going to be a big deal, and it kind of wasn't. We said that there would be self-driving cars by this point, and then it kind of isn't. And so it's easy to like roll your eyes a little bit and say, okay, you say that this technology is going to change the world, I'll believe it when I see it. But AI really is that technology, as foundational as the internet itself in a lot of ways. The things that it can do are almost infinite. Basically, in the most basic possible terms, companies use these gigantic data centers, and they're building them by the bucket load of massive amounts of computing power that they're using to basically record the entirety of the internet, all the books ever written, all the videos ever posted to the internet, all the social media content, all of the encyclopedias, everything goes into this machine. And what comes out is you can ask it a question and it will answer in plain English. And it can do some very effective, but not quite as good as me, writing and summarization. And there's certain things. So there's a lot of time, you know, the last generation of work, we talked a lot about automation in blue collar roles, but yes, AI is this technology that is going to introduce a whole lot of automation into the knowledge economy, which is a world that people thought was probably going to be spared from automation. But the reality is the technology can do some really impressive things. If you say, hey, ChatGPT, can you write me an essay for my wife for our anniversary, but do it in Shakespearean style, it can do that. And so it really upends a lot of not just how we work, but what the workforce looks like, the kinds of skills that we need, the kinds of jobs that are needed. And it is really this disruptive force in the same way that the internet was, that the personal computer was, that the cell phone was, you know, in previous generations.
Wow. That's fascinating. Really fascinating stuff. How can we realistically, I'm sure a lot of people wonder this, and you talk about this, transition to working 4 days a week when we still need to respond to clients or collaborate with colleagues and other divisions in the company who are still working the full 5 days a week? How does that work?
Yeah. So we found a lot of really interesting solutions to this problem. And we profiled companies who had different approaches. And to an extent, it is a little bit unique to the individual organization. We spoke to a PR firm, a publicity firm that takes off half day Mondays and half day Fridays. And they basically realized that like no one really sends emails in the first half of the day on Monday or the last half of the day on Friday. And so they just stopped working those hours and nobody noticed. Others, so we talked to a tech company in Toronto in the book, and they have one member of their tech team, of their coders, basically has to be within 10 minutes of a keyboard for that day off. So once a quarter, that one person is assigned to be, they can do whatever they want. They just have to be able to get to a computer to respond to an emergency if needed. And then they also have one member of their customer success team, of the people who are working directly with clients. They make sure that they have one person who's designated. They have to check in 3 times a day at like 9 a.m., noon, and 3 p.m. on that Friday. Again, it only happens every few months. It's your turn. You have to be there. Everyone else gets the day off. And designating that one person lets everybody else kind of take a step back, knowing that if someone has an emergency, that it's actually, if someone's there to cover for it. But what we find often is that this challenge looms so much larger in the mind than it does in reality. Like there's so much anxiety around not having full coverage from 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, when it really isn't that difficult. I mean, what happens if someone calls you on a Saturday right now? If it's an important client, you pick up the phone, you have the conversation, you go back to playing golf. Right. You can do that on a Friday too. So a lot of the times people are really anxious about answering this question, and the solutions are pretty, there's some very creative, complex solutions, but usually organizations can find a pretty easy answer on their own.
What are some of the obstacles that companies face when they transition to the 4-day work week, and any success stories from those companies that have done it and it's working beautifully?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many companies that have done it successfully. In fact, I believe it's 93 or 94% of all the companies, hundreds of companies that have done a 4-day work week trial have kept the policy permanent after the trial ended. So there's a lot more companies that actually see a lot of success with it than don't. The difference between those who see a lot of success and those who don't are those who spend a lot of time planning for it and getting ready for it. It's sort of like the transition to remote work. We make that comparison in the book. If you were to just go into the office and say, hey, you know, starting next week, everyone's going to work from home, it's going to be a disaster. If you were to go into the office and say, hey, from now on, everyone's going to work 4 days a week, probably not going to go over great. But if you go to your team and say, hey, if everyone can find ways to reduce the amount of time that they're working while still delivering the same results, you can have the day off. They'll say, well, how do we do that? What do we do in order to get there? I want that day off. And so you'll say, as a business owner, you'll say, well, you know, there's these new technologies that can help us be more efficient, make better use of our time. And if you adopt those, then you can shave off a whole lot of time and still deliver the same results. And, you know, if you're planning a meeting, maybe just take 10 minutes off of that meeting, 20 minutes off of that meeting, and maybe take it from 10 participants down to just like the 5 that you really need so that the rest of the people have that time back. And so if you engage your team in this collective mission of finding waste, of really focusing on like the results that matter for the business and getting rid of all the noise, you know, having a clear policy for when managers actually need to step in and approve things, but letting workers really just do things without those approvals to the extent that's reasonably possible. These little strategies that we talk about in the book that deliver some really big time gains. And when you put them all together, a lot of companies are able to do as much in 4 days as they previously did in 5, if not more. Again, as long as they've done the work on the front end to kind of prepare and to make that transition.
Wow. Jared, I love this section in your book where you really break it down for the reader. Tips, techniques, actionable steps, news you can use. With tips in this, I think it was chapter 15 called Your Guide to Doing More in 4. And you break it down with things like audit your workday, give every hour a mission, own your own to-do list. I love that one. Increase focus by minimizing disruptions. Make peace with imperfection. Schedule strategic breaks. Time your breaks. And practice makes progress. There's so many wonderful strategies, and how you describe them are so evocative and fantastic. Can you tell us about briefly some of your favorites and why they are?
I think so. A lot of this is based on my co-author's work directly with organizations who are making this transition. And so, you know, this is battle-tested, real-world, you know, scenarios that yes. He's been in. And I think one of the things that stuck with me the most out of all the things that you just mentioned, just while you were describing, which, you know, we wrote about, he has a line where he says companies or individuals need to stop giving gold-level effort to bronze-level priorities. That a lot of the times we assume that everything is of equal priority and has to be done to the best of our abilities. But if you take a moment to really break down like what is worth my full effort and what is okay at 80% of effort and you know, the 80-20 rule, like can I just get 80% of it done in 20% of the time and it's good enough and it's not that important? You know, a lot of us, we're in this mode of like, we want to be seen as doing just the best work that we're capable of all the time. But then we end up, as he said, giving gold level effort to bronze level priorities and just trying to stop people to like take a breath and think, is this worth as much time as I'm giving it? Wow. Can actually give you back a lot of time that you'd otherwise put towards things that might not need that much effort.
That's fantastic. Ultimately, why is it time for a shorter work week? And what do you most hope that readers will take away from your book, Do More in 4?
I would say the reason why it's time for a shorter work week is because, as we explained in the book, the 5-day work week, which we all know quite well, was born out of a period of rapid technological change and social upheaval that happened in the sort of early 1900s. And there was this moment of opportunity where work, as we knew it, was evolving so rapidly that there was an opportunity to stop and question whether the 100 hours that people were working at that time was sustainable and whether it was the best way forward. And over time, the 5-day work week was established as a standard that has lasted for the last 100 years. And I would argue that we are now in another period of rapid advancement and social upheaval and technological change. Mm-hmm. And we have this rare opportunity to once again stop and ask, is the way things have always been done the right way for today and the best way forward in the future world that we're going to inhabit? And I think if you were to do that exercise, and we sort of walk through that in the book, I think the conclusion is that in a knowledge economy, in a world of AI, in a world where social ties are declining, where the environment is in a terrible place, in a world where birth rates are declining because the dual income is absolutely necessary and yes, families don't have enough time together, I think you'll see that there's an opportunity to solve a lot of our collective challenges, or at least make some meaningful progress in a lot of our collective challenges by reducing the work week without compromising business outcomes.
Fantastic. Who is this book ideally intended for? Is it for business people, organizations, freelancers? I know you're going to say for everyone, but who do you see as the main audience for this book?
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting. We did an initial version of our book proposal that was very much for anybody in the world would be interested in picking it up and reading it. And then we did a different version for our ultimate publisher, which was Harvard Business Review, that was much more focused on leaders and human resources leaders and also business leaders. And they actually came back to us and said, you know, this is a little too high level. Can you make it a little bit more friendly to the average reader? And so where we ended up was very much in between. So I know you didn't want me to say all of the above, but we really did strive to balance making the argument for businesses, showing different businesses and different industries that have done this successfully and seen great results from it, but also for individuals who want to advocate for a four-day work week at their organization. And we make it accessible. So you don't have to be a business leader or even into a certain industry or career or human resources professional to understand the arguments that we're making and the case that we're making.
Fantastic. Well, I'm a believer now. I think it's fantastic. I want to give this message to everyone. We even discussed it in our team to talk about, should we do a 4-day work week? Like, should we consider that? So it's interesting. You're really a successful freelance writer and now author. And so do you have any advice? There might be someone listening here on Zoomer Radio, AM 740, who maybe wants to do some freelance writing at any age. And we always say dreams have no expiration date. So what would be your best advice?
The best advice that I would give to any aspiring freelance writer is to know the audience that you're pitching. So if I have a story idea, there's a difference between the stories that I pitch for the Globe and Mail versus the Toronto Star versus the National Post versus Time Magazine. And understanding who goes to those publications and what they're looking for really allows you to speak to the editors that you're pitching in language that they understand. So if you can say, I know you cover this subject area, but I think you're missing this important piece of the conversation, and here's why I'm the right person to tell that story, that is the recipe for a successful pitch.
Jared, as an aside from all of this, you have a wonderful broadcasting voice. And I have listened to you on some of the podcasts that you've been a part of and that you've run, and that's a podcast. But have you ever thought about getting into broadcasting? I always thought this about you, by the way, as an on-air anchor, reporter, journalist. I'm thinking like Peter Mansbridge vibes. Have you ever thought about that?
Flattered that you would consider that. You know, my first love was always writing. I got into journalism via writing. And I think I would, you know, I like to do public speaking. I like to be on stage. I'm not shy of, you know, the camera or the microphone or a live audience. So I do really enjoy that stuff. But I also really enjoy having the opportunity to, you know, go back into my little office at home and just sit down at my keyboard and write stories. That is really like what brought me into this industry and what I'm most passionate about. So definitely would consider part-time broadcast work, as long as I still get to do a lot of writing, which again is the thing that brings me the most joy, the most bliss.
That's so fantastic. Well, that brings me to the question that we ask to everyone at the end of the show. And of course, I'm going to ask it to you now. Maybe you've answered it. I don't know. What is bliss for Jared Lindzen?
I think that after growing up fearful that I would end up as one of those cartoon character dads who's afraid of their boss and hates going into work and is always being reprimanded for being a minute late and, you know, the tie's out of place, I am just so grateful that I have a job that I love and that I get to set my own terms and start and end times and have all the flexibility in the world to spend with my family and to do the things that I'm passionate about. When I first thought about what my career would look like as a journalist, or even before I knew I wanted to go into journalism, there was a lot of anxiety about what that would look like. And the place where I've landed is just perfect for me. And I love it.
Isn't that, how great is that? I love that. Love that.
Don't take it for granted.
That's so fantastic. Jared, what's the best way for people to contact you, connect with you on social media, and to get a copy of Do More in 4, Why It's Time for a Shorter Work Week by Joe O'Connor and Jared Lindzen?
So the book, Do More in 4, Why It's Time for a Shorter Work Week, is available anywhere books are sold, Amazon, Indigo, all the usual places. You can also check out our website, domoreinfour.com, where we have all of our media appearances, where you can buy the book, more information about us as authors and the book itself. My personal website, jaredlinson.com, is where you can find all of my journalism work. Any stories that I publish go up there, which, you know, given that they're all in different places, it kind of just brings them all together in one convenient package. If you do want to reach out to me directly, jaredlinson@gmail.com is the best way to do that. And I think that was all the questions, unless I'm missing one.
Social media, Instagram, TikTok, Facebook.
LinkedIn, I would say, is the one that I'm using most commonly. Yeah, LinkedIn.
LinkedIn, awesome.
Under my name.
Well, okay, so this may or may not be in the show, but I'm just going to say this, and I don't know if we're going to include this, but I'm just going to share this. So little fun fact, everyone, I used to be known for writing wedding speeches and bar and bat mitzvah speeches and other speeches for celebrations and events, 60th birthday parties and 40th birthday parties for many of our friends and family. And I did this a lot as well as for your family, Jared. And one day they said, "Thank you, Judy, for your services, but we won't be needing you anymore. You've been replaced by Jared Linson." And you know what? They were right to do so, because you are really the real deal. And
I was thinking about it earlier. I'm pretty sure that the first time I wrote anything that wasn't for school was in your office, and it was a speech for a friend's bar mitzvah. And I don't know if you recall, but we had this little carpool group of friends, and every time it was one of our bar mitzvahs, the other ones would go to Judy's office, and you would help us write these speeches. And they killed. I'm telling you, like, as a 13-year-old, to be delivering a speech that has the whole room in stitches, really, I think that sparked an interest in public speaking and in writing from a very young age. So I give you a lot of credit. Again, for me, before that, writing was a school assignment. Wow. And after, writing was a way to light up a room and to get people excited and engaged and, you know, patting you on the back when he got off stage, and it completely changed my perception and interest in writing. And so I give you a ton of credit in sparking that interest for me.
Thank you, Jared. You just made my day. That is so great. It's really been an honor. And as you know, I have followed your career with great excitement, and I really wanted to have you on the show. So I'm so delighted that we could make it happen. It's been an absolute honor to have you here. Thank you, Jared.
It's my pleasure. I look forward to returning after I write my next book.
Can't wait for that. Each week we spotlight a fabulous person like Jared Linson, who is living their bliss. So if you're an author, artist, actor, writer, therapist, life coach, yoga, meditation, or mindfulness expert, or really anyone who has found and is following their bliss, we'd love to hear from you. For those of you who don't know, I'm also the bliss coach. That means I help you get unstuck, gain clarity, find your passion and purpose. Reach out to me at findyourbliss.com/coaching. I'm also on Insight Timer, the number one free meditation app. All you have to do is search up Judy Liebrack. And of course, you can always follow us at The Bliss Minute on TikTok, Instagram, and Facebook. I would love to thank our wonderful guest, Jared Linson. What a delight to have him on the show today. Also, thank you to Mag Ruffman, Siobhan Kylie, producer Chelsea Lockstedt, Eva Shabbatai, Olivia Vigiani, audio engineer Juliana Yanicielo, senior editor Lauren Kaminsky, video editor Sierra Brown Rodriguez, audio producer Faz Kazi, and everyone here at Zoomer. And of course, a big thank you to our sponsor, the Create Fertility Center. As well, thank you to Garrett Flores for the beautiful pink roses that adorn our set each week. For everyone here, I'm Judy Liebrack, reminding you all to consider a 4-day work week. It's a great idea. Working hard, but having that extra day to be with family, friends, and maybe do that one thing that will bring you one step closer to finding your bliss.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.